You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Back in the late 1970s, in the late 1970s, early 80s, when I was getting my very useful Bachelor of Arts in English, I was immersed in the work of, you know, Ulysses. I was reading the Peloponnesian War, all those kind of things. And the reason I took that course was because I've been in chemistry and I found it boring, but I found English really fun and exciting and difficult. And so foolishly, I abandoned my pre-med degree and got the Bachelor of Arts in English. And at the time, I was also reading like E.E. Doc Smith. I was reading the whole of Craftian stuff. I was reading Philip K. Dick and Stanislaw Lem, and kind of thinking, you know, well, why aren't these guys being taught with, James Joyce and T.S. Eliot? And now, having read your book, I can see we needed somebody who had read both and understood both to write the synthesis of the two. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That is an enormous compliment. You know, I on the general subject of why fiction and why science fiction and fantasy are apparently not allowed to be literature, I think that this all goes back to the other thing that Northampton is famous for, other than me and shoes, and that is the Gothic movement, which was all started by a Northamptonshire clergyman, James Hervey, who wrote the most miserable but beautifully worded pieces of text. And he was thrown out of the Methodists by John Wesley because he was hanging around with too many evangelicals. He went on to become the most beautifully miserable writer in the English language. He inspired all of the graveyard poets. The graveyard poets inspired the later graveyard poets, who were just into all of the skulls and bats and sort of tombstones and things, which of course inspired the Gothic writers. And the Gothic movement was scandalous because it was sensational. It wasn't like the novels of Jane Austen or of Sheridan. It wasn't a middle-class comedy of manners. And all of the genres that evolved from the Gothic, which is like all of them, crime, horror, romance, all of them, they can never be considered as literature because of their scandalous parentage. But sort of, that's very nice. I'm very, very grateful for you for saying that.
Let me introduce you here briefly. Alan Moore is widely regarded as the best and most influential writer in the history of comics. His seminal works include From Hell, Lost Girls, V for Vendetta, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He's also the author of the novels Jerusalem, notably longer than the Bible, and his short story collection is Illuminations. His new novel is The Great When. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
My pleasure.
I even read this novel. I got grokked what it was about, and it made me think about the history of English literature. And one of the things that I think is very interesting is that here in America, our understanding of the American story is all based pretty much on nonfiction and very mundane stuff. George Washington, I cannot tell a lie, blah, blah, blah. You in England have, from the get-go, embraced fantasy and horror and even science fiction as part of your national story. I'm thinking of from The Sword and the Stone to The Knights of the Round Table with Merlin and Arthur, and then, I mean, up to The Knights Who Say Nay, the British consciousness is always associated Britain with magic and the elements of the fantastic. I'm wondering if you have an idea why you think that is and why you included the magic and the elements of the fantastic in your story of the essential Britain.
Well, I would say that that's because you can't separate magic from... You can't separate it from literature. You can't separate it from history. It's one of the strands that is tangled into our narrative. And I would say that probably in the case of England, this all starts with, I'm going to forget the guy's name. It may come back to me later, but this was the guy who in the 13th century? He translated the Bible into English, which caused all sorts of problems. That was a piece of troublemaking that went on for a long while. It was deciding that it was a huge political move. Because in those days, the church controlled everything, and the church was Catholic, and you didn't have hymns, you had psalms chanted in Latin. So this was very, very revolutionary. And the Lollards, which was the kind of political movement that grew up around this, they were active in the Civil War, things like that. So there was a political component to this. There was a political component to language. And, but that importantly was making English into a sacred language, where there had only been one sacred language before in the Western world, and that was Latin. But this allowed people like, say, John Bunyan, another near local boy who spent a lot of time in prison. I think the last 34 years of his life was spent in Bedford Jail. Now, John Bunyan, he wrote what is arguably the first fantasy quest novel. Pilgrim's Progress. He has his central character, Christian, moving through all of these different allegorical lands and meeting these different allegorical creatures, you know, the Slough of Despond and the Giant Despair, all the rest of them. I know that Michael Moorcock has cited John Bunyan as probably the first fantasy novel. So you can see that that was political, it was religious, it was mystical. And people like Bunyan, they gave birth to people like William Blake. William Blake, who was as important to art and literature as he was to magic. I think it was William Blake's idea that the world in our heads, the territory of the imagination, is just as real in its way as the physical world surrounding us, and is possibly more important than the physical world surrounding us. And this, of course, is probably the basis of my magical thinking, and it is certainly the basis of the Great When. The idea that there is another world more important than this, that is immaterial and which underlies our world.
You know, 50 years ago, yep, God, more than 50 years ago, my family moved from Northern California to Southern California, a city called Covina. Next Covina was a city called West Covina, imaginatively, and in West Covina was one of the world's first shopping malls called Eastland. Next to the Eastland Mall was a large grocery store, the Lucky Grocery Store. And in that store, right when I walked in, I was just thunderstruck by an entire wall of paperback books. And whoever ordered those books at that Lucky's Mall, I realized, had a profound impact on who I became, because they ordered a lot of a line called at the time the Ballantine Adult Fantasy series.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I was introduced, and I actually still have some of those volumes. I bought the Clark Ashton Smith paperbacks, the Lord Dunsany paperbacks. Now, not part of the adult fantasy line, but also sold with them, were these Pam books with these, oh my God, just terrible covers. But I bought them anyway, two of them, by a man named Arthur Machen. Tales of Horror and the Supernatural 1 and 2. And I have to say that reading Machen's story, The White People, really changed my life and turned my mind around. It's a very simple story. Premise is that an 8-year-old girl wanders off of her family plot somewhere in England and into a kind of ultra-surreal fantasy fairyland. And she finds it delightful and fun, but as a reader, you're just terrified. And I thought that this is one of the most profound things I have read, and I still to this day love it. I think it's an incredible piece of writing. Talk about the influence of Arthur Machen on your thinking, and certainly on this book, because he's, in a sense, a central character.
That's very true. I mean, like Arthur Machen, I probably became associated with him through the same Pan books that you did originally. I had first heard his name in H.P. Lovecraft's essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature. That was where I got most of my grounding in, great horror and fantasy authors, people like Lord Dunsany and people like that. Machen, he is somebody who I loved his work when I read it, but I probably didn't appreciate it deeply enough. It was only in later life that I came to Machen again and began to realize that there was more going on there. I remember that when, what was it, 1996, something like that, when I was doing one of my site-specific magical works, this was around Red Lion Square in London, which was just down from Gray's Inn Road, where Machen lived for many years. And it was the place where Machen, when his first wife, Amy Hogg, died, he was plunged into a profound depression, and something happened. He reported in his biography, Things Near and Far, he reported that he had gone out into London to find that he was in a different city. He was in a city that he called Baghdad, because characters from his own stories were approaching him in the street. He was approached by the young man with spectacles from his novel, The Three Impostors. He was approached by the actress, Miss Lally, from the same novel. They were telling stories of being persecuted by this evil diabolist, as the characters in the novel are. And Machen was in this enchanted state. Of course, the three people were respectively W.B. Yeats, Florence Farr, who was a member of the Golden Dawn and an associate of Yeats and an actress, and Aleister Crowley. But it was more than that. There were just dreamlike scenes coming at him from the alleyways, and then he moved on to a different state, a state that he called Sion, where everything was golden and glorious. And from that point, he returned to Earth and joined the Golden Dawn. And I don't think that Macken found a lot in the Golden Dawn. He later said that there are marvels in Kabbalah, but a lot of the rest of it was simply imbecile abracadabras. I think that Macken, he had his own magical thinking and his own spirituality. I mean, I'm a member of the Friends of Arthur Macken, and I get their excellent quarterly journal, Faunus, which is covering all sorts of aspects of Macken's very varied life, his literary life and his personal life. When it came to writing The Great When, I'd been thinking about this idea of how the London that we think of when somebody says London, it's not the physical city as it currently exists. We are summoning up this mythical London that is made up of, I don't know, personal memories of the place, the stories, the history, the legends that we've heard about it. That is what the essential London is. And I found in Arthur Macken's story N, upon reading that again, that seemed to perfectly express the thing that I was wanting to talk about. This idea that, yes, there is another London that is hidden behind our own, but is occasionally accessible and is in some way truer and more real than our own London. And, of course, in Macken's story, he supports this idea by a fictional book, A London Walk by the Reverend Thomas Handpole, which is a fictional made-up book like Lovecraft's Necronomicon or any of these other made-up books that exist in literature. But I thought, wouldn't this be a good way into the story? Like, what if that made-up book suddenly turned up at your second-hand bookshop? What would you do? I saw this as giving me a way into the story and a way to also talk about Macken, who is an author that is he's far too much under-discussed, I think, in the modern era. Apart from, you know, people who are particularly fans of his, I don't think it's generally acknowledged what a fine writer he was, who covered such a lot of ground in his career. No, I mean, Arthur Macken, he is probably the presiding genius of the Long London novels.
You know, I've done, I think, probably more than 2,000 interviews and that read a lot of books in these years. While I was reading your book, one night I found myself consumed by dreams that I only half remember, but all the dreams I knew to be involved directly, sourced directly from your book when I was in them, though they had nothing to do with your book directly in terms of plot or setting. I just said, while I was in them, I said, this is from this book I'm reading. Now, for the past 5 years, I've been the sound editor and music composer for a show called The Dream Journal. And so I've heard my share of interviews with dream experts on this show. Oh, that's what it is. It's a show where somebody interviews, the host interviews a dream expert and then takes and calls people, can have their dreams analyzed by this expert. So I'm well acquainted with dreams and their detritus, even though I myself don't have great memory of dreams. And so I'd like you to talk about, clearly, dreams are important to this book. So talk about the importance of dreams to you and your writing. I understand you do keep a dream journal.
I I would like to keep a dream journal. I have kept a dream journal, but one of the problems that I find is that my dreams do tend to be fragments and only remembered. It's generally if I have woken up early in the morning and then gone back to sleep. In that second period of sleep, I will remember more fragmentary dreams. They are only fragments. I don't keep a dream journal. I used to keep one, but I'm essentially a lazy person. And I can't be bothered when I wake up, so the dreams just melt away. But, however, on one night a couple of years ago, as I was drifting off into sleep in that kind of hypnagogic rubbish that you sort of have to swim through before you get into a complete actual slumber, I've got these, you know, just words and nonsense phrases drifting through my head. And amongst them, there was the phrase, "and then Dennis Knuckleyard," at which point I just woke up, sat up in bed laughing, because I never heard such a stupid name. It had a strange resonance, but it was kind of comical. So I determined that I would have to use that name in some forthcoming fiction. And so luckily, I had it laying around just when the Long London Quintet turned up. So I was able to do that. Now, in terms of dreams, the person who was the biggest influence on me regarding dreams would have been my late friend and mentor, Steve Moore. Steve did religiously keep a dream journal for over 30 years. And it was a parallel life. He kept a journal, his diary of real events. I think his dream journal was probably longer than his diary, and probably more detailed. And it was through Steve that I explored some of the stranger phenomena of dreams. Like, for example, I was very interested in J.W. Dunn's book, An Experiment with Time, where this very sober engineer, after having a prophetic dream, decided to, as best as he could, to scientifically investigate the phenomenon. And he discovered that him and his associates were having premonitory dreams all of the time, but were forgetting them. And in Steve's case, because he did keep this journal of all of his dreams, it was very interesting. Every time that I went down to see Steve, every couple of weeks, because I didn't remember many of my dreams, I would always ask to have a look at Steve's dream journal, because that was a way of, it was almost like having the dreams myself. By reading Steve's dreams, I could do some vicarious dreaming. I remember on sometime shortly before Steve died, I remember going down there and he talked to me about things that had been happening recently. A collection of his old stories that Marvel Comics had just republished, some interest in another one of his characters for a video game, a dream of walking through Oxley's woods and coming across this lake that wasn't there in actuality. And he talked about all of this. And then I read his dream book and I came across dreams that he'd written down that seems to describe those exact things. Talking about discussing this character with some people at Marvel Comics, talks about a computer game involving this other character, and most bizarrely, this sudden lake in the middle of Oxley's Woods that had been in real life occasioned by thunderous rainstorms. And it was basically an enormous puddle, but sort of many yards across, you know. But when I asked Steve about this, did you have these dreams after you had the events then? Steve didn't know what I was talking about, because as soon as he'd typed up his dreams, he forgot them, because he had no need to remember them. But he went and checked in his actual journals to see what dates these things had happened. And on the first two instances, it was a couple of days before. He'd had the dream a couple of days before the actual thing had happened. With the third one, the coming across this huge, gigantic lake-sized puddle in the middle of Oxley's Woods, he'd had the dream that morning. He'd had the dream of coming across a lake in Oxley's Woods. He'd typed it up. He'd immediately forgotten about it. He'd gone out for a walk and discovered a lake in the middle of Oxley's Woods. Dreams are a very important part of our life and our narrative. I don't know what they are exactly, but they may just be the complete random white noise of our minds, but I suspect it's more than that. I've had enough significant dreams to suggest that there's something more than that going on. And so, yes, there is, in my writings, I do generally like to acknowledge that people do have a dream life. I like to throw in a good dream sequence now and then.
In many ways, lots of this novel is a dream sequence of you dreaming on the page. The language in this novel is some of the most amazing I've come across in years, since my college years. It reminds me of reading, when I was reading Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, in terms of the quality and the immersive feel of the writing. It seems like you're just having gangbusters fun doing this. And yet it also seems like maybe it's terrifying for you at the same time. Talk about just creating the prose style for this universe that you're creating.
Well, I have always, I suppose, been a maximalist. You know, sort of... don't use one word for something if 10 will suffice. You know, it's, I remember Mike Moorcock, he was asked to contribute an introduction to a new wave of literary Puritans who believed in very strict rules and restraints upon what modern fiction should be. And I remember Mike saying, "But, you know, I wish you every luck with this. It sounds like a great project, but I'm not really in that camp." He said, I'd like to play with a full orchestra, and if possible, with five full orchestras. I'm very much a fan of the decadent writers, of people like, I think, it might have been Théophile Gautier, who gave as his definition of decadent writing, he said that decadent writers should feel free to plunder from our most ancient mythologies and also from our most modern technical vocabularies. And I think that's great. That is the approach that I tried to bring to it, to steal from the past and the future, to combine all of the various literary influences that I have absorbed over my life. And I also think that as I've been writing now all of my life probably, but professionally for 40 or 50 years, and it seems more and more like what you're trying to do is to literally cast a spell by spelling, to cast a spell over the reader. You are trying to take their consciousness somewhere where it hasn't been before, and with each word to keep them in that state. It's an attempt at mesmerism. I also pay a lot of attention, not just to the use of words, but also to the rhythm of the words. I like my prose to have a rhythm. This is something that I probably picked up from my poetry performance days when I realized that, yes, a poem can look great on the printed page, but if you try to read it out, you'll find yourself stumbling because there may be an extra syllable there that there shouldn't be. And then I realized that, well, the reader is doing that as well. The reader is providing their own rhythm to the prose. So, yes, for your printed work as well as your spoken word work, try and do that. Try to keep this rhythm going. And with the Long London books, it feels very strange. It's like when I first read Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast book.
Wow, now there's a showstopper books.
Well, that absolutely. Those were the books that probably first taught me what it was possible to do with the human imagination. But what Peake was doing with that was it was the architecture of his language and the language of his architecture, the way that he was actually creating a physical space with Gormenghast. But I can still remember Gormenghast. I can remember the Room of Roots. I can remember the kitchens. I can remember Steerpike's climb until he'd got all of the rooftops spread beneath him. I remember all of this better than I remember places that I have actually visited in the real world. Gormenghast has a...
You know, that what you're describing is my definition of great writing, because the great writing can stay in your memory just like a vacation of a place you actually went, only it can stay in your memory better.
Yes, it can. And I think that also in a specific form of writing about place that will do that. It creates a space in your mind that will endure probably for the rest of your life. I mean, Mervyn Peake is a great example. A more recent example would be Susanna Clarke and her wonderful book, Piranesi, which is... When I was talking to Susanna, I was complimenting her upon it because it is a sensational piece of work where she is word by word, brick by brick, creating this environment that will be in your mind forever. These sort of these endless labyrinth of kind of classical rooms with sculptures of enigmatic and cryptic things. And the surf, the tide coming in across these huge galleries. Yes, it's a kind of psychic architecture, if you like. You are actually building with words these structures in the human mind. And so that was something that I was definitely trying to do with Long London.
Now, you just used a phrase I really like, psychic architecture. And I think this gets to one of the things I love about your books, which is the vision of magic. And I think this also informs your creative life, too. We are, here in America, you're just bombarded with, like, kind of supernatural magic thing, shows and TV and writing, where somebody essentially... makes a wish and it's granted and there's no, and everything magic is something that comes from the outside. And I think in this work, that magic is some, is a transformation that's wrought up upon the magician who practices it. And I think that's a fascinating idea.
Well, that is all that magic can be. I have heard far too much lately from various sources about how by using some magical or pseudo-magical technique, you can materialize your every material wish. That sort of, if you, I think the television host Noel Edmonds over here said that if he would was to write his wish upon the palm of his hand. That was like a message to the universe, and he would have it provided straight away. I've heard chaos magicians say the same thing about their sigil magic. One thing that strikes me about all of this stuff is, yeah, this is material magic. And if you have a system that promises that by doing a sigil, you can have your every material wish granted, yeah, I suppose that will be very popular until a more efficient magical system comes along, like, say, Amazon.
You know, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the only way that magic can work upon the world, the only way is to let magic work upon you, to work upon the magician. That is the only thing that magic can work upon. Of course it is. But if the magician applies magic to his or herself in the right way, it can make them a better person. It can make them a more capable person. It can make them a person who actually can act upon the world. That is how magic works. It isn't just for ordering, I don't know, somebody to fall in love with you or one of your enemies to sort of suffer a horrible death, or perhaps for, you know, some money to turn up in your bank account. That's not what magic's for. It's for transforming yourself.
To make you into a more compassionate and understanding person who sees within the world existing the things they want. You know, one of the things we're talking about magicians, there's a magician at the heart of this novel, a real magician, Austin Osman Stare, is it? Spare. And
Austin Spare.
Now, as soon as I read this name, I had to look up because I had come across his work maybe 40 years ago. I bought an album by a fellow named Bill Nelson, used to be the guitarist for...
Oh, yeah, Bill Nelson, yeah.
Yeah, he was a guitarist for a band called Bebop Deluxe, and he did an album of ambient music called Close Encounters in the Garden of Light, I think is what it was called, or Chance Encounters in the Garden of Light. And that in that book, in that album, in the liner notes, he cited Austin Spare as his influence with regards to Spare's work in automatic writing. And that name has stayed with me for, well, obviously, 40-something years. Talk about the influence of Spare's work on your creative life and also as a part of this novel.
Well, I mean, look, you mentioned Bill Nelson. I mean, my wife, Melinda Gebbie, I've never met Bill Nelson, but she met him a while ago, and she was saying a long while ago, this was when he was at the peak of his magical activities and his interest in Spare. Austin Spare, I think I first discovered him on the cover of the artwork series Man, Myth and Magic, where on the first issue there was a picture of... I'm not sure what it's actually titled, but I've always seen it as the face of Pan. It's just this glowing face with these incredibly wise eyes. And then I came across Spare's automatic drawings, his book of ugly ecstasy, all of this stuff, and I became enthralled. And then I found out a little about his magical practice. I've got one Spare painting in the room here. I've got a number of his books and a number of books about him. The thing with Spare that makes him so particularly interesting is that he rejected the formal magic of Aleister Crowley. He decided that he was just going to make up his own magical system and apply it. And he started out as a a comfortably off middle class boy. He was the son of a policeman in Snow Hill. But and although at the age of 16, he was welcomed, he was hung in the Royal Academy and was talked about as a sort of a young genius. He was very influenced by Aubrey Beardsley, but his work was all of his own. People like John Singer Sargent were saying that, yeah, this is the coming face of British art. And he so disliked that West End art world that he moved to South London, places like Brixton and Southwark, and kept the company of working class people, of criminals, prostitutes, brawlers, builders, destitutes, because he found that life more vibrant, more interesting. And in the period that I'm writing about in The Great When, which is 1949, he had just had his studio bombed in the Walworth Road on the same night where he received injuries that paralysed him down the right side of his body. He saw this as revenge on Hitler's part because Speer had refused to paint Hitler's portrait. So he saw the bombing of his Walworth Road studios as Hitler's revenge. But it left him with nowhere to live. Eventually, a friend of his, a woman called Millie Payne, she took him into her house in Brixton. But he could only live in the basement, which was a room with the window boarded up. It was 6 feet square. This was his studio. This was his bedroom. This was his living space. He slept on two chairs pushed together. He was surrounded by stray cats, which he had taken in from the streets. So that was the period. It got a little better later. He was able to move upstairs and to a sort of a decent room. This was probably not long before he died, which is an event that I cover in the second book. But Speer, yeah, he was an extraordinary person. To my mind, one of the only people deserving of the mantle of, say, William Blake. There are a lot of similarities between the two men's lives, that they both started out in relatively prosperous homes and rejected that life to live in fairly squalid circumstances, but to do the most extraordinary visionary art. So, Austin Speer was somebody that I definitely wanted to get in to this book, along with a lot of the other low life characters that I've dredged up from real life to serve as the cast of these novels.
And they're really entertaining. I have to say, I love the hell out of them. Now, you released this book on 1st of October this year. So I'm guessing that it was most of the prose that was probably locked down a year beforehand.
Yeah. Probably.
Okay. So one of the things that struck me, this book, just to give the listeners a brief idea of what the hell we're talking about, we have an itinerant kind of a lackadaisical, low-life style teenager, Dennis Knuckleyard. He comes into possession of a lost Arthur Machen book, one that he created, and it's a ticket to a place he really probably doesn't want to go. And he has to get some help to get it back. And from there, it's just wildness, and readers need to read it. And Mortar was just here to provide some background. But one of the things that struck me is, as I read your descriptions of bombed out World War II London, I thought, oh my God, he couldn't have known. How could he have known? And let me just read this one part. With grimy buildings clinging to existence beside pulverized expanses that given up the struggle. It looked pretty much the same part, the same to him as every other part of London. No worse and no better. He supposed that bombs were unsurprisingly great levelers. As I read that description, I thought, I have seen that so many times on the TV in pictures of Gaza. And I could not help but think of your equation, unconscious, completely unconscious, and not self, not willful in any sense, turning London into Gaza gives the residents of current London and current America and every other wonderful metropolitan city in this world an idea of how close they are to Gaza. It was a very serious thought. My God, this guy has, you know, he's been dreaming of the future and while seeing the past. Did you make that discovery yourself?
Well, no, I think that what the sorry truth is that the landscape of war is eternal. I grew up in 1953, in late 1950s, Northampton. Kevin O'Neill grew up in, he was born the same year as me, but he grew up in London. We both spent our childhood playing upon bomb sites. These were our play areas. Although in Northampton, it wasn't a bomb site. I first thought that these patches of, you know, demolished rubble that had once been people's houses, I thought that, oh, that must have been the fault of the Germans. Later, I found out, no, the Germans didn't really bomb Northampton. That was the fault of Northampton Council. But Kevin, on the other hand, he got the real thing. He was surrounded by bombed out places. London was barely there psychologically and physically. It was in pieces. It was a field of rubble. It was a tabula rasa. And that, I think, is the landscape of war. It is always people sitting in dust and rubble or trying to dig their relatives out from under the dust and rubble. And one of the things that I did learn that was quite fortuitous in writing The Great When I was writing, there's a little epilogue, if you like. It's only a few pages long. It's called The Old Man at the End. And this is set in 1999, 50 years after, 60 years after almost, the book that you've just read. And when I was researching 1999, which I lived through and remember, but you always have to research these things. When I was researching that, I found that in 1999, the last of London's bomb sites had been cleared for redevelopment. So that is how long it took for the scars of the, at least the physical scars of the Second World War to heal. It took a generation or two growing up with that legacy and that's not just the physical bomb sites, it's the bomb sites in everybody's heads. It's the trauma of war which gets passed down through generations. You know?
From 5 million years to Earth.
Sorry?
There's a famous movie here in the US that was titled 5 million years to Earth. I think you guys knew it as Quatermass in the Pit. Again, that this book recalls parts of that just in its ability to synthesize history, what we would call maybe science fiction and supernatural fiction, all into one narrative. Now, one of the things I just love the characters in this book, and one of the kind of the characters that I loved was a guy, Hosworth. A real person, Machen's kind of a proto fan / publisher.
Oh, Gorsworth, yes. He was a very Very interesting character. I think that he was described as an exceptionally minor poet by somebody, which is a bit cruel. But Gawsworth, he wrote the biography of Arthur Machen. He was also a friend and confidant of Matthew Philip Scheele, who wrote The Purple Cloud and lots of other fantastic fiction. When I believe that in Scheele's last days, he was living up a tree in Hyde Park. And when Scheele died and was cremated, Gawsworth kept his ashes in, I think, a biscuit tin, and would serve them as a sort of a spicy addition to food, or stir them into the coffee of his guests. Gawsworth himself, I believe that he ended up living on a bench in Hyde Park. He was a fantastic drinker, but he has done much to preserve the memory of Arthur Machen. He published the collection of short stories that Arthur Machen didn't want published. Arthur Machen thought, oh, this is old stuff. But Gawsworth kept pestering him. And I think that Arthur Machen probably regarded Gawsworth as a tremendous pest. But sort of, there was this collection, The Cozy Room, that Gawsworth was intent upon publishing. And Machen, thinking, oh, this is just old stories and I'm not very pleased with any of them, I'm going to write a new one to include in this book that will perhaps make it a worthwhile collection. And that story was N. So without Gawsworth, there would have been no N and there would have been no Great When, you know?
Just as a note of trivia, when I spoke with Margaret Atwood, she mentioned that she had written her a thesis on M.P. Scheele and the Purple Cloud.
Wow.
So there you go.
I believe that in America they made a film version called The World, the Flesh and the Devil.
I didn't know that. I know the title of the movie. I always thought it was a compelling title for the movie, so maybe I should look it up.
I think that is based upon The Purple Cloud. Melinda got the movie the other day to watch, and I've not seen it, but I noticed on the back that it was based upon M.P. Scheele's novel The Purple Cloud.
One of the things I think that this book is intent on doing is especially in scenes with the other London, is it creates a very dreamlike feel. And one of the things I love are some of the images. I mean, just the first image that our hero sees, it is like in the midst of a riot, he sees a woman who's like 10 or 12 or 15 feet tall walking through it that nobody sees. And I love this idea that we are surrounded by the supernatural, but our brains just resist it. And I think that there's that really has the ring of truth to it.
Well, that is something that suggested itself to me. That it was when I was writing that scene, which it's not our hero Dennis Knuckleyard, it's the poet David Gascoigne, who I think was 18 years old at that time, had just published his third book, had hosted the International Surrealist exhibition in London, had saved Salvador Dali from certain death when Dali had insisted on appearing in a diving suit without realizing that he wouldn't be able to breathe. And so David Gascoigne had intervened with a spanner and saved his life. But yeah, David Gascoigne, I thought he probably would have been along at the Battle of Cable Street. I've got no evidence that he was there. However, when I was talking to Ian Sinclair, who knew David Gascoigne, he said, oh, yes, he was there. He was definitely there. He talked about it. So that was a lucky guess. But I wanted to introduce this figure, the Beauty of Rights, who that was probably that is the, that was early in the writing of the book, and that was probably the figure that summed up the other London for me in some way. Just this gigantic, beautiful woman wading through the riot, and everybody's looking the other way because you couldn't allow that into your life without your life being shattered. I mean, this is the thing about fantasy. This is the thing that I dislike about a lot of modern fantasy, that the children go through the back of the wardrobe into Narnia, and it's no big deal. They are not in therapy for the rest of their lives, which they would be with even the slightest glimpse of Mr. Tumnus. If anything fantastic happened, we would never get over it. We would not, if something happened that was contrary to what we know to be true about reality, then our entire reality would be shattered. And this is what I wanted to get over, that this fantasy world that I'm creating here, the world of the Great Wen, this is not a place that you could bear to be in for too long. I even make the sections when we're in the Great Wen are written, they're in italics, they're in the present tense to make it all that much more urgent. They're in a kind of hyper-poetic prose. I want it to be so overwhelming that the reader will find it, the reader and the characters will be overwhelmed and will find it just a little bit unbearable. Because I suspect that if any of us were transported to another world, that would be how we'd find it. So, yeah, that was what I wanted to do, to preserve the shock of fantasy.
Yeah. Congratulations, you have. Now, this is a wonderful narrative, but it's only one of five books. Do you know where the rest of them are going, or are you just going to brave it out, like, you know, face the fire, as it were?
Bit of both. I have, the one thing I've got, I really hate television shows, boxed sets, where it's a good premise and it becomes fairly obvious 3 or 4 episodes in that the writers are making it up as they go along, that they haven't got an ending in mind. That none of this stuff is sort of actually, you know, they hadn't got a story. Exactly. I do have a story. I know roughly what will be happening in the remaining 3 books, because I'm nearly at the end of book 2 at the moment. I know how the whole series is going to end. I know the main points along the way, but I'm leaving a lot of it open for serendipity, because the thing is, I'm quite a good writer, and I figure that having this experience that I've had for 40 or 50 years of writing serial fantasy, that I think I'm pretty confident that whatever situation arises, I will be able to make something decent out of it. So I'm leaving it open so that I can have interesting things happen that will inform the story. And I'll give you an example. Just a couple of weeks ago, I mean, the current book is set in 1959 and it features, amongst other things, the recording genius Joe Meek.
Here in the recording industry, we hold him, you know, in a deity-like position for his amazing electronic inventions, you know, the Joe Meek EQ. Oh, my God.
He invented modern recording, the mixing desk, all of these things. It was Joe Meek, who was a slightly unstable individual, who was doing a lot of diet pills, to keep control of his weight, and came to a very startling end in 1967, which I'll be dealing with in the next book. But sort of, I received this letter a couple of weeks ago from somebody living in Northampton, a woman who gave her name as Elaine Duke. There was a strange cartoon on the back of the envelope that showed a cat in a graveyard saying, "Hello, help me." Now, I do get some very strange letters from time to time, so I was a little bit apprehensive upon opening it. But yes, it was a letter from Elaine Duke, living in Northampton, who is the widow of somebody called Robbie Duke, a name I didn't recognise. But apparently Robbie Duke was originally called Patrick Pink, which is a name I did recognise. Patrick Pink was Joe Meek's studio engineer and the last person to see Joe alive. I was planning in the opening sections of book three to have a section that would have had the point of view of Patrick Pink. So Elaine sort of was telling me all sorts of things about her husband's fascination with seances and the famous scene with the talking cat in Highgate Cemetery where Joe had recorded it. And she also told me that in late 1966, early 1967, her husband had said that Joe had had a part-time worker at his Holloway Road studio who was just stacking tapes, stuff like that. And this person's name was Dennis, surname unknown.
Alrighty then. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, I think I know what Dennis's surname was. But I'm leaving things open so that things like that can happen.
So you can surprise yourself, which means you'll shock the heck out of your readers.
And keep it fresh for me, because if I don't startle myself occasionally, I'm not going to be able to startle the readers. You know, I believe that I have to feel everything that I want the readers to feel, and to feel it genuinely, you know.
Well, I cannot wait. For one, and I hope that we can speak again. When is the next book coming out? A year from now, I hope?
I'm hoping maybe. I've got 18 months to write each of these, and it is taking me that long. But I'm hoping a year's time, and I might be able to speed up on the later ones. We'll see. We'll see.
I look forward to reading them and hopefully to talking with you again. I've been speaking with Alan Moore. His new novel is The Great When. Let me tell you that The Great When will begin when you open that book. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. It's been terrific.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.